Wildlife by the Numbers, a podcast about wildlife ecology focused on the proper and robust design of studies concerned with the conservation and management of fish and wildlife. We hope to entertain and enlighten young and inspiring wildlife ecologists along with seasoned professionals. Our wish is to help guide the application of science in conservation. Hi, I'm Matt Butler.
Grant Harris.
David Stewart.
Today is going to be more of a general overview of the different techniques that are available to you as a wildlife biologist to estimate abundance and reduce your bias and get an accurate estimate of abundance from them, provided you have adequate sample size and a robust design and those sorts of caveats. In a previous podcast, we spoke about bias. And in that podcast, we talked about using marked and unmarked techniques for reducing bias. And we didn't get into that in very much depth. At the time, our context with bias was that we acquired a representative sample. And then we actually had some feedback from listeners, and they said, hey, can you talk to us more about marked and unmarked techniques and what those are and how they can be used and their application in wildlife biological studies? And so we thought we take their suggestion and get into that some more. But before we do that, let's just talk about what we mean by...
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
You said unmarked and marked.
Yes, young man.
What in the world is that?
Excellent question. Well, let's start with marked. That's a bit easier to conceptualize. Marked simply means you have an animal like an ocelot that has, you know, spots, the ocelotic pattern. You have tigers with stripes. You have zebras with stripes. And those are all unique identifiers. They all have unique patterns. So let's say you took a picture of them in a camera trap. You can then subsequently identify the same individuals over time based on the pattern of their coat or their pelage. There's other ways you can mark things. You know, you can put little ribbons in fish. You can put ear tags on animals. You can put GPS collars or VHF collars on animals and mark them that way. So as long as it has a unique identifier, you'll be okay. I mean, Randy's been doing some pioneering stuff. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but, you know, but if you don't mind, more creative and advanced methods, Randy, like that you do with pine snake and alligator snapping turtle that are, you know, have like marks.
Well, they still have unique IDs. So you're just using a pit tag. It's a tag that's inserted inside the cavity of the animal. And in this case with alligator snapping turtles, we have tags that are mounted on the backside of their shells.
Then you have little sensors that can read that pit tag as it goes by, so you can get them a mark that way. And so they're all marked in some manner. And if you do use some sort of a collar, a lot of times people put, you know, unique tape on that, you know, different colors of tape so you can see it, because a lot of times the GPS collars look the same in a picture. And ear tags have unique numbers. So you can mark things in different ways. Either they are naturally marked by their coat patterns or maybe some sort of horn or antler configuration, or you've marked them yourself. Unmarked is when you have something without marks. So you can have an animal that does not have a unique coat pattern, like you say, like a mule deer, or it has a bighorn sheep, and you don't know what it is. You didn't mark it yourself. It could be bass in a pond. It could be songbirds without bands on them. Whatever, it's not marked. And so you have to have techniques that account for unmarked animals where there is no unique identifier to them. Unmarked techniques. So we got a handful here. Well, they're not in any particular order per se, but we'll talk about distance sampling, removal sampling, and end mixture models. And these are techniques that you could use for unmarked. Again, there's no unique identifier, so the coat pattern has nothing you can tell from. All the animals kind of look at the same. You can't really tell from one to the other. Now, of course, if you work with animals close enough, you'll start seeing, hey, I can actually tell that raccoon apart from another raccoon. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about a population with hundreds of individuals that you're unfamiliar with. Distance sampling. Matt, would you do the honors and maybe describe what's going on with distance sampling in a rather broad overview?
Broad and brief, I hope. But distance sampling is a technique in which you take advantage of the fact that things are harder to see or detect at greater distances. So, and these things could be anything from aluminum cans to large animals. And so what you're doing is taking advantage of the fact that 100 meters from your transect, the line you're walking to do the survey or the point in which you're standing at to do the survey, something 100 meters is way more difficult to see than something at 50 meters or something that's right at the point or the line. And so you then expect the distribution of distances to fall off, or the distribution of detections, pardon me, to fall off with distance. So the greater distances, the fewer detections you have. And if you make one simple assumption that you have 100% detection at the line, which in most cases is true, we could talk about some cases where that wouldn't be true, but in most cases is true, then you can do some modeling techniques to estimate detection probability for that whole transect. So if we don't detect anything further than 100 meters, or we cut, use 100 meters as our cut, our truncation point, what is the probability of detecting something within that 0 to 100 meter width? And we can model that. We can calculate that detection probability. And then we just use that to estimate abundance. So let's say our model tells us that it's a 30% detection probability. And we detected, let's make it easier on the math here. Let's say it's a 50% detection probability. And we detected 100 animals on all our transects. Well, 100 divided by your detection probability. So 100 divided by 0.5 is 200. I'm simplifying it quite a bit, but that's functionally what's happening under the hood in distance sampling. It's a technique that's used for birds, lots of songbirds, usually from point counts. It can be used in transect-based settings for birds as well. It can be used for ungulates like deer and elk, both from the ground or from aerial-based applications. It's used a lot in aerial survey applications.
How have you used distance sampling in the past?
I've used it for turkeys from both road-based surveys and aerial surveys. I've used it for prairie chickens from aerial surveys. I've used it for ungulate surveys from the ground. Helped New Mexico Department of Game and Fish with some aerial-based pronghorn surveys that use distance sampling.
So how do you survey prairie chickens from the sky? What does that look like? Methodologically, what does that mean?
You get in a helicopter and you fly a transect.
Like a line.
You're flying a line. And you're looking for birds. And with prairie chickens, you're probably not going to see them unless they flush. But if you get there in a helicopter, guess what? They're going to flush for you.
They will. How high are you off the ground?
Pretty low. I forget the altitude we were flying at, but it was right up the deck.
So you're in the helicopter, and you're counting the chickens you see and recording the distances.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea, foundation idea, being that chickens close to the helicopter are more likely to flush, and the ones further out are less likely to flush or less likely to be seen. And from that, you build a detection curve and you get abundance, as you explained earlier.
Right. Yeah. One of the things we'll get into, I think, deeper detail on distance sampling in another podcast and talk about, well, what do you do when you miss detections on the line?
Yeah, that'd be a good one to talk about.
But that might take a minute.
Removal sampling. Dr. Stewart, I know you've done that in the recent past.
Yes. Well, in removal sampling, animals are captured or removed over successive periods. In the case for, let's say, fish, you know, that's passes. And the depletion of numbers is used to estimate the total population size. So as more animals are removed, there are fewer remain available for capture. And this decrease in capture rate provides information about detection probability, which is used to extrapolate those counts to estimate a population size. I've seen this method commonly used, probably more commonly used in surveying small streams, but also I've seen it for feral hogs and small mammals. And one of the biggest assumptions of the method is that you're surveying a closed population. So it's restricted in the case of fisheries to streams that have a defined study area or a site area, and they typically use block nets on the north or upstream and downstream, rather. Portions of that stream to then define that closed population and then start depleting it using removal sampling.
So when you do it, Randy, like, how long is your trial? Do you like do a sweep and you catch as much as you can and then you wait a few minutes and do it again? Is that typically how it goes?
Basically, I mean, it's much more formal than that. You typically want to maintain some constant effort. So if you're going really slow, for instance, this case, we're speaking solely to, I guess, fisheries. I think it applies to other examples. Let's say you take your time on the first and you spend 10 minutes on the first removal pass. And then the second, third, and fourth, and fifth, you spend maybe a minute or two. And that's a different amount of effort. So you want to make sure you keep the effort constant. So that way the counts are not an influence based on how fast you walk through the system.
That makes sense. In your examples, in your the work that you've done, you've caught the fish, put them in buckets or so, and then at the end you put them back in.
Mm-hmm. This technique is actually used in fisheries because of being able to define a population in small streams, maybe even medium-sized streams. Once you get to very large streams, it's hard to define a closed population for this method to work. The effectiveness of the method and the accuracy of the results declines pretty sharply with, you know, the width of the area that you're trying to sample.
Fair enough.
Well, hey, Grant, why don't you tell us something about this thing called in-mixture sampling or in-mixture modeling?
In-mixture modeling. I shall do that. Thank you. I believe it began in 2004 with Andrew Royal kind of putting that into the ecological field, kind of making some adjustments to some previous work. And since then, it has slowly gained more and more traction in ecology and wildlife biology for folks to use. So the way N-mixture works is you capture an animal, and I'll get into more details of what that kind of looks like, and you do it over different defined capture sessions. It could be a day, a week, a month, depending on the species.
Do you capture or count the animals?
You count.
Okay.
Okay, count. In my head, I was thinking like camera trap that captures it.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Right. But you're really just counting, Matt. Thanks for the correction. So you can count things in any number of different ways. You can go out there and count them yourself. You can use remote methods like acoustic recorders, or you can use trail cameras, what have you. So you're counting animals in a defined sampling interval and then analyzing those counts in each interval over time. And that repeats through different techniques, one of them which folks typically use is Bayesian, will allow you to get an abundance estimate and a detection probability from that process. So what we've been doing recently is using trail cameras, and others have been doing it prior to us, but we're actually doing that with a few populations that have a census. We know how many bighorn sheep are in a pen. We know how many bison are at Wichita Mountains Refuge within a fenced area. And since we know the truth, that the sense is valued, we can put out camera traps, do this N-mixture modeling, and then get an abundance estimate and compare that to the census value. And so again, with the trail cameras, what we're doing is taking images of animals as they walk by and then defining it by 7-day intervals or 3-day intervals, getting a total count of animals. I'm simplifying a bit here. I'm skipping some steps, but this is the gist of it. You get a count in a 3-day interval of how many, say, desert bighorn sheep you have, or in a 7-day interval. And again, from that repeat at each camera, you get a site-specific abundance, and then you can sum those abundances across cameras to get a total abundance estimate. Any more on that or the other ones that we should cover for unmarked?
So how's that working? Like, so you got counts. So at station one, you got 3 time periods, let's say, or 4 time periods, and you count 3, 4, 3, 2. Mm-hmm. And so what's going on, if you can, in a simple way, like under the hood there with those 4 counts that gets you to both an abundance and a detection probability?
Randy, I want to kick that one to you. You're better off covering that.
Yeah, well, you're using the variation and counts in your modeling as a function of detection probability and abundance. And though there could be some identifiability issues in doing so, if you are able to ensure identifiability is met, because you're accounting for that variation also in the detection process of the binomial distribution, which is that first level of that model hierarchy, you can then extrapolate that out to estimate what they're saying, true abundance.
Okay. One of the points which you're speaking to is, if we have our sampling periods too long, and I'm making up a number like a week, and you count everything in the area, essentially you're counting everything in the area, there's nothing to estimate. So it's like you just default to your maximum count at that point.
Right. And so that, and that's a case that happens with like camera trapping. But if I'm doing a bird point count, I'm never there for a week. I'm there for 5 minutes or 10 right. minutes, and then I go into the next point.
Yeah, maybe another day you do that same point again. Right. You know, over every other day, that could be your sampling
effect. Right. And so in that case, you don't really have that problem that comes from or that you encounter with camera traps that you got to deal with camera traps.
Right. It's actually a good problem to have because you get so much data from that because it's out 24/7, 365 versus right. like a 5 or 8 minute point count
right.
you know, every day. And yeah, some of the assumptions in Mixer, the biggest one is that you can't count an animal twice at your site. So if you're doing a bird point count, when you see and you count a bird, you go to another point and that bird flies over and you count it again, then you're violating that assumption. So you have to make sure that your distance between your sample sites avoids double counts and the amount of time that you're there avoids double counts too. If you're there doing your bird point count too long and the bird falls twice and you count it twice, you've also violated the assumption too. And that can inflate your numbers, which in the end will actually deflate your estimate because it improves your detection. Any more on these?
No, we made them sound super simple, right?
That's right. That's good. All right, marked. Again, animals have marks. Either people mark them or they have unique identifiers themselves, like spots and stripes on their coat. Let's get into capture, mark, recapture. Dr. Butler, you want to handle that one?
Yeah, it's like, here, you want to drink this ocean?
Here's a straw.
Right. I mean, there's so much there. There's so many models that one can apply. It all depends on your circumstances and situations. And depending on your mark types, in other words, are they uniquely identifiable or not? Because you can do this even if you don't have uniquely identifiable marks. Just depends on the model. Are you residing them or recapturing them? What assumptions about closure? Am I doing one repeated, one capture event and one recapture event and one reside event or multiple capture and recapture events? All of those things are going to drive what model you choose. I've used this in real simple circumstances with like elk and mark recapture, and even that can get pretty complicated. But the idea behind the technique is, okay, so I go out to the population and I capture 50 animals, and I put marks on them all, and then I go back out to my population the next week, and I capture a whole bunch more animals. And let's say I just capture 50 again. I'm really good at capturing 50 animals for some reason. So I marked 50 to begin with. Inside that second sample of 50 that we caught, there were 25 of them that were marked. And so that means that our detection probability is 50%. And since we captured 50 that second time, our total population would be 100. Of course, it's way more complicated than that, depending on what model you're doing or what kind of data you have involved in the process. And you can get to lots of other parameters with this technique than just abundance. You can get to survival or apparent survival, so other demographics about the population using these techniques, which is cool and handy, depending on what your questions are.
Matt, you spoke about just some quick things here. Recite and recapture. What's the difference?
They're different in that recapture means you are physically going out there and recapturing animals, whereas mark recite means you're going out and now you're surveying animals out on the landscape, not recapturing them. You're not touching them again, but you are trying to identify their mark. You may or may not be able to identify who they are, so the uniqueness of that mark, but you can identify, yep, that one's a marked animal or not.
Okay. And there's different techniques if you can identify the individual versus if it's marked or if it's not marked.
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. And closure. What do you mean by population closure?
If you're trying to get that abundance, you're usually assuming something like animals are not dying, new animals are not being born into the population, and animals aren't leaving the population or entering the population from somewhere else. So if I was going to do a Markery side experiment on an elk population in, say, Bosque del Apache, I'm going to want to do that over a short enough time frame that I don't have births, I don't have deaths, and I don't have immigration or emigration happening.
Okay. Yeah, I think you understand that you can see how intuitively that can mess things up with if you had like a herd of elk, you're doing an abundance estimate on a herd, and all of a sudden you had like 25 elk come in.
Right.
Then start feeding, and then 50 leave, you know, go someplace else, and it's like your variability is going to be off the charts. It's going to be.
Well, just think about the example we just talked about. If we captured 50 on that second time, and you had a whole bunch of animals come into the population between the first and second session, well, now your estimate of abundance is biased. I'm going to say high.
It is biased high, yeah, because your detection's going to go down.
Yeah.
So instead of a 50% detection, you're going to have like a 25% detection.
Right.
And you're going to have 200 animals.
Right. Right. And again, it's kind of even hard to say that your estimate is biased high, because what is your population? Your population is in flux through your time frame. So at the first period, it might have been 50, and at the second time period, it was 75. So what are you even estimating? Something, some average of those two time frames? You know, so it gets weird really fast.
Yeah. All right. Last one we kind of had on the docket for talking about is a little modification on this one. It's spatial capture recapture.
Yeah, so Matt just gave a great example of capture, mark, recapture. But the capture probability is oftentimes assumed to be uniform across the study area, which is unrealistic in many situations because animals are more likely to be captured or observed at traps closer to their home ranges or activity centers. And spatial capture recapture is kind of founded on traditional capture recapture methods where you have partial identities, the stripes and the dots that Grant spoke to earlier, even you know, other unique identifiers such as tags. But it incorporates spatial information, not only about where they were observed, but also, spatial information about where the traps were located and where they are observed in association with their capture histories. And by accounting for this, it helps produce more precise estimates of total abundance, as well as a description of their spatial distribution across the landscape.
So you're saying if you have a species like an elk, that's inhabiting some forest and landscapes and some grass and landscapes. We'll just keep it like with a two ecosystem system. And you have your sampling in bulk in some sort of a capture recapture framework. With this spatial capture recapture framework twist, you can now get a detection probability for elk in a forested environment and for elk in a grass environment, and then use that to get a more precise abundance estimate instead of using the same detection probability in both spots.
I would keep it simpler than that. Just to say it's just one study area. You go out and you tag a bunch of animals. Let's say in this case, collared a bunch of elk or put some ear tags on them, however you want to do it. In this case, you now set up a trapping array. And these trapping array is a series of camera traps. It could be a single camera trap at a site or a double camera trap. And so that way you can get two different views of that, that ear tag to ensure that that number is correct. And let's say the trapping array is much larger than the spatial distribution of how the species is using, in this case, elk, that period of time in that study area. The whole concept now is to track those uniquely ID'd animals. And in this case, it'd be a little challenge. So let's say they all have unique IDs to keep it very simple. Now you're tracking where these animals are using the landscape based on your detections, your unique capture histories, and where you observe them based on the physical location of your camera traps. And then through that, based on the spatial points of your capture histories of those animals, you can now start estimating the detection probability based on the spatial relationship between their observations and, of course, where the camera traps are. And you're assuming that a trap that's much farther away than the animal's activity center, there's, you know, lower detection probability of seeing that animal. And that's sort of the assumption. It's sort of a half normal detection function. We go back and rewind a bit from the distance sampling. You know, you're assuming, you know, that relationship where you have fewer detections further away from the observer. And in this case, you're somewhat modeling that and you're including it in the capture recapture modeling framework, in the detection process to get more precise estimates of density. It's also downscaled, unlike traditional capture recapture, where you don't really know exactly what that estimate means. A lot of people assume that it's a density, the total number divided by their study area. It is the actual density estimate. But in this case, you're able to estimate the animal's activity centers to then get that downscaled estimate of density. And that also allows you to estimate their spatial distribution. Because they could be using areas disproportionately more than others.
So the detection probability that you're getting, is that per individual animal that's marked? Is it per camera that you're speaking to here? Or is it per location, just habitat quality at the site? What does that detection process represent?
Well, you're getting a detection probability for each individual animal, but you're also estimating sigma, which is the parameter describing, you know, how quickly that decrease in distance from one trap to the next is, which is a standard deviation. But you are producing a detection probability by estimate, but you're estimating collectively that sigma just in general overall.
Gotcha. Matt, Randy, I think we did all right. We talked about unmarked and marked techniques, right? We went to broad overview distance sampling, removal sampling, and mixture sampling. Then we got the capture, mark, recapture, and then spatial capture, recapture. There's other techniques out there. There's a whole bunch of other techniques we could talk about. I'm sure we will get into them in future podcasts, probably inadvertently, and get over our heads really quick. We always appreciate you listening. And Matt, how about closing us out?
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Wildlife by the Numbers. We really do hope that you enjoy it. See you later.
Take care, all.
See ya.